I can tell three lies. And I don't have to tell you guys what those lies are. I just have to tell you that I'm going to tell three lies. So there you go. I haven't picked what they are yet, but we'll go from there.
I like
your honesty. There you go. So my first sponsor told me that certain people fall down the stairs and others fall down the elevator shaft. We all end up in the basement. And my story is one of the elevator shaft. I got sober when I was 14. And I drank alcoholically and daily from the time I started drinking until the time I found you guys. I have never gone back out. Relapse is not part of my story. I know it's part of a lot of people's, and it's very valuable for that experience, but I also mention it because it's valuable for the people that came in and never had to go back out, that you're done. If you think you're done, you don't have to go back out, and you're home, you made it. So what happened for me is that I... the program says from Baltimore, so I'm sorry if you thought there was going to be like some hard Skid Row talk. This is about a Jewish kid from D.C. who's went to private school and did a lot of drugs. I was adopted, and I mention that because I related a lot to the speaker last night, and I want to thank him. I related a lot to that kind of feeling out of place, feeling a little bit different. But I had, the other thing with being adopted is that, like, I have no alcoholism in my family at all. Now, my birth family, maybe, probably. But I was, like, the black sheep way before I picked up a drink. And I felt out of place, and I relate to people in meetings that talk about missing that day in kindergarten where they taught you how to live life and kind of get along with other people, you know. So I was just kind of always the class clown and getting in trouble even before I found drinking. And what happened for me is that I found alcohol at an early age, 11 or 12, and started hanging with the kids that, you know, could get me what I needed, and started to make friends and or acquaintances that would put up with what I was doing. And very quickly, that was my entire life. You know, I centered my whole life around drinking and using. And a lot of people talk about having fun and then fun with consequences and then consequences. I never had the just strictly fun portion. It was fun with consequences for a very short period, and then it was just consequences for me. But what happened was alcohol worked. Alcohol was the first solution that I ever had in my life. Now, it stopped working at one point that I'll get into, but alcohol was the solution that I needed. You know, it allowed me to feel like I was a part of. It allowed me to feel like I fit in. It allowed me to act how I wanted to and not have to be in my head constantly. And so that's all I did, you know, and quickly everything else that was there just dissipated, you know, no school, no, you know, showing up for family events or anything like that. And I remember when I was new, I used to tell people that I was homeless because I thought I was really badass, you know. But really what it was that I would run away from home just to drink. And when I'd run out of, like, money or couldn't panhandle anymore, I'd just come back. And so I put my family through hell and they never gave up. You know, I was an only child, and my folks had never experienced anything like this, you know, and they just kept plugging away. They just kept trying to help. And it was pretty amazing. My mom sent me a message this weekend when I was flying out here saying, you're going to do, you know, good luck speaking. And I said, I thanked them for everything they did and for not giving up, you know. And they told me that they love AA, you know. And so what happened for me is that I have, like, a ton of consequences in my story. So it's just, like, psych ward and rehab and jail and psych ward and rehab. You know, it's just constant. So that started happening when I was probably 13, and I learned how to play the game really quick. You had your group therapy sessions, and then you'd have to say the right things, and you'd act up and get put in the quiet room. And the speaker Friday night talked about four-point restraints, which was awesome. I was in that a lot. But I also had the 6-point restraints, which I liked, which was also your throat and your, you know, kind of hip line. And so that was kind of where I, you know, like, that was where I was at as, like, a kid, you know. Like, if I, like, fucked up, I'd be put in restraints. It wasn't like I was grounded, you know. And what would happen for me is that it would, the same cycle would repeat itself every time, you know, and for the first year or so, like, I wouldn't have any inclination of stopping, you know, like, it wouldn't come across my mind at all. I just knew I got to play this game, I'll get out, and then I'll be able to go back to what I was doing. And eventually what happened for me is that I started to want to not feel this way, you know, and every time I'd get put in an institution or get arrested, I would tell myself, this is your opportunity to stop. And sometimes I would try, you know, hard. Sometimes I would just kind of give it a half-ass effort. But I always went back to drinking, you know, like it was the with and without a solemn oath for me. And so basically what happened for me was that New Year's Day was not my resolution to get sober. I had the fireworks last drink. And my plan was that I was going to get up. I think I was kicked out of school at this point, but I figured I was going to get up around noon and probably go hang out with some friends, which I had lost everybody at that point, so I don't really know where this fantasy came from. But I would go to a party. I had an undercover cop following me around for dealing drugs, and so nobody was inviting me to parties anyway. So this is a total fantasy, but I was going to go to a party, and then I was going to find a cute girl, and then midnight would come around, and it would be like Hollywood movie, okay? So at 9 a.m., I was at the Metro, and I was buying two bottles of wine and a bag of dippers, what we call dippers. I don't, you know, it's formaldehyde. It's fun stuff, but so I was buying it from a guy from Hebrew school that had stolen all the liquor from his dad's cabinet, you know? And so by like 4 or 5 o'clock, I was at a friend's house that I grew up with, and we're just hanging out in his basement. These are not alcoholics. These are not drinkers. And they are so worried about me that they decide to call my parents because they don't know what to do. They think I'm going to like go into a seizure or something like that. And you know, it's bad when you're like a kid and you call your friend's parents, you know, like it's gotta be really bad because you don't want to like tell on your friend. So anyways, what happened for me is that I went home, I got into a physical altercation with my father, which didn't happen. Like I'm from like pacifist hippie family, you know, and the cops came and there was 4 cops in my kitchen and there was 1 woman cop. And I thought that she was very short and I thought that maybe I could take her. So I went that way. And she beat the shit out of me, you know? And none of this is new. At this point, like, this has all had happened before. But what had changed was that they cuffed me and hauled me out. And somebody across the street who was actually a family friend was having a New Year's Eve party, you know, with the neighborhood. And everybody was out there because we're not from a neighborhood where there's cops all the time. And everyone, it's just the shame that I put my parents through is amazing, you know, because I still didn't have any remorse at that point. I was kicking and screaming. And I remember I was demanding that I sit in the front seat, which I think they let me, actually. They think they let me sit in the front, which is bizarre. But they took me to Suburban Hospital, which was our closest hospital at the time, and they put me in 4-point restraints on the bed, and they didn't let my family in because I was a danger to myself and other people. And they talk about, in the back of the book, they talk about the window of opportunity, and for me, that was that window of opportunity because I saw my parents looking in who had been trying everything, you know. I got them kicked off health insurance for all the institutions they had to put me through, you know, and they just didn't know what to do, you know, and I said, I want to stop this because I don't want to feel this way anymore, and I want to stop this because I don't want to make other people hurt this way. And what had happened was alcohol had stopped working for me. Now, I had the physical effects of alcohol were still there, but I didn't have that initial feeling a part of, feeling loose, feeling like I belonged, you know, like that didn't happen, you know, and I was just having to drink more and more, and it was all failed attempts. So what happened is they shipped me up to the psych ward up a couple floors, and that window of opportunity dissipated, you know, because I thought to myself all night and all day, how can I do this? You know, I don't know any other way. You know, looking back, more will be revealed. I think I may have had, I think I forged my slips, but I had to go to some sort of group therapies or meetings or something like that, but I don't remember it. So I didn't have any, I'd never heard of AA. You know, I said, this is way too difficult. And they had a payphone in there, and I started making calls to get set up. And what happened is that I got released from that psych unit, and we drove right past my neighborhood, and I tried to jump out the car. And they took me to a 28-day treatment center. And this is probably my 5th or 6th, so I'm not, like, real excited about this. And the fast forward version is that I escaped from that rehab because I'm a badass, you know. And I was in a gown, and it was January, and it was snow on the ground, and there was a cop, you know, I was like a block from the rehab, and this cop was like, stop, you know. And I kind of looked at him, and I looked at this like field, and I was just, and I just ran, you know, and I made it like six strides, and I fell. And so they took me to a hospital, discharged me. They were going to discharge me for rehab because you can't escape rehab. That's a no-no. And I got picked up by a guy who was in the fellowship who worked at the rehab. And he was on the adult wing, not the adolescent wing, and I had never met him before. But what he did was on the way back to the rehab, he told me his story. And it was completely different than mine, but I related to the feelings that he had, and I related to what, how he knew how his relationship with alcohol. I related to it exactly, you know. And what he told me is that he said, I want you to go to a meeting when you get out of here. I want you to try and prove me wrong. Just try it. And I did that. I showed up on a Tuesday night at 8:30, like all of you, in the back of my dad's Volvo, smoking Marbreds. And I pulled up to Church of the Little Flower, and there was all these fucking happy people sitting out there, including Jeff, who's in the front row. It's pretty powerful to have somebody that was at your first meeting here. And I had long hair, and I hadn't showered in months. I was dressed in all black. I had cuts all over my body, because whenever I wasn't drunk, I couldn't sit with myself. I hated myself so much, I couldn't sit with myself. You know, I looked like death, you know, like I was the last person you'd reach your hand out to. And what these guys did was they stuck their hand out and say, how you doing? And it was the first time that I could remember that somebody asked me how I was doing that wasn't being paid to ask that, or wasn't my parents, just because they you know, were obligated to love me, you know? And I don't remember anything that was said in that meeting. I don't, I remember who spoke, actually. He's still sober. But what I do remember is that afterwards, I was chatting with the guys, and they told me that they wanted to take me to a meeting tomorrow. And I asked somebody who would become my sponsor if he could pick me up for my second meeting. And what I always tell people is that that's the last thing that I did by myself in AA. And probably the last thing I did by myself in my entire life, actually. But and then after that, somebody had mentioned this weekend about their first resentment. It made me think of this story, is that I flicked my cigarette butt when my dad pulled up, you know, and I got in and I said, see you guys later. And I turn around to see, because I was like, I'm sure they're going to be talking about me and laughing about how this guy's a degenerate, you know. And so I saw somebody pick up that cigarette butt from the curb and put it in the ashtray. And that was my first resentment in AA, because I was like, why the hell couldn't he have just told me that to put it in there, you know? Like, this is, you know, these guys are holier than thou, whatever. So what happened for me is that I caught fire with AA, you know, because what it was that I was finally home, you know. Like, it wasn't an instantaneous thing for me, but AA did for me what alcohol had done. I finally felt like I had a job. I felt like I had a place. I felt like I belonged. And I was embraced by everybody. And I didn't have any responsibilities when I got sober. I'd been kicked out of school. I'd never had a legal job before. And so I didn't have to do much for those first 3 months other than go to meetings. And I went to probably 3-4 meetings a day. That's all I did. I talked to people. I listened. I got picked up. I didn't have a driver's license or a car for the first 3 years of my sobriety. And I finally realized that I was an alcoholic, you know, and I struggled for a long time past those initial 90 days of being an alcoholic, because I was a kid, you know. Like, I was sitting in meetings with people that would talk about drinking for 50 years and losing a wife and a car and kids, and that wasn't my experience, you know. But what happened for me is that probably 6 or 7 months, I remember vividly the meeting I was in where I related more to what they were saying than I related out. You know, like, I was the one that was putting that wall up. I was the one that wasn't able to relate to anything unless you looked exactly like me, you know. And that's where you guys come into play. You know, like, I started getting involved. We were bidding for Ikipa in Baltimore, actually, in 05. And I got asked to, I just tagged along, really, to the committee meeting. I was the P.O. box chair, and there was, we never got any mail. So what happened was I would go from high school to the P.O. box, and every month I would be like, my report is we got 2 coupons from PetSmart and a catalog for furniture. And we bid for 2 years because Katrina pushed IKEPA New Orleans back a year. And out of those, that committee of 2 years, I think there's probably 12 or 13 of us, and I think almost all of us are still sober, and I keep in contact with almost all of them. And I got calls from people this morning, like all over the country, that were on the committee, like, hey, heard you're speaking, good luck today, you know, and that's amazing, you know, like nobody wanted to be my friend, nobody thought that I was responsible enough to have a relationship with before this happened. What happened for me with, I want to talk briefly about my experience at Buffalo AA, because it's been really powerful and, you know, we're in Buffalo. So what happened was, we were driving up in an RV to the World Convention in Toronto when I had like 6-7 months sober, and we were on this WIPA MySpace group, and and Derek, who's sitting down there, put a message up saying, if anybody's coming through Buffalo on their way to Toronto, just stop by my house. Here's the address. And we were like, this guy is fucking nuts because he doesn't know who's going to come in, you know? And we pulled up at like 8 o'clock in the morning after we'd been driving all night with this RV, and there were 17 of us in there, and there was already like 30 people hanging out at this guy's mom's house with like sitting, they were sitting out on the curb, they were smoking in the back patio, they were in the house. And we were like, is Derek here, you know? And they were like, oh, he's up in the shower. And I was like amazed that this guy just trusted all of you with his, you know, with his property. And I made a lifelong friendship with him. And I started coming to Buffalo when I'd have time off of school to hang out. And I would always have time off like Christmas break. So everybody'd be like, where are you going for winter break? And I was like, I'm going to Buffalo, New York. And they were like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know? And what I love about the AA here is that it's no bullshit, and it's about recovery, and it's about helping other people at any lengths. You know, sometimes we can get a little bit distracted from the message, but we were all hurting that bad, and we were able to listen as only the dying can be, you know, and that's the meetings that I've been to here and the people I know here, they take recovery seriously. And I met Jackson after that. He got sober a little bit after that, and I met a lot of the guys in the crowd after that, and I'd come hang out. And it's just been, it's a real blessing to have relationships with people all across the country that you can just call up, see how they're doing, check in, and you mean it. And so I'll hop around here a little bit, but what happened for me is that I got back into high school. I went to high school. I got a job with somebody who was in AA, and that ended up becoming my career at some point. I went to college in Indiana. I saw there was one guy from Indiana. Did he wake up? Is he here? No? Okay. So I went to college in Indiana to study what I was interested in, and that was a big moment in my sobriety because everybody used to tell me that the only thing between you and a drink is God at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the difference was at 2 o'clock in the morning, all my buddies, we were at fucking Denny's hanging out after the meeting. So I didn't really have that. My 2 o'clock in the morning moment came when I was sitting in a town of 30,000 people in the middle of the cornfields. And I was looking at the meeting schedule and there was like 5 meetings, you know? And I had come from a place that there were 1,600 meetings a week, and I hated about 1,550 of them, but that's still 50 meetings a week that I could go to, you know? And those 4 years I spent there really enriched my spiritual act, you know, part of my program. And I'm guilty of this as well, but sometimes I shy away from talking about the God thing, my experience with God, because of how new people may react. But I remember that I was pretty much the most anti-God guy ever, and I was at least willing to sit and listen because of how I felt, and I didn't want to feel that way anymore. So, you know, the purpose of the big book is to find your higher power, so I think it's a disservice to not talk about your relationship with God and the complexities of that. You know, like my relationship with God has not been like the same since I got here till now, and it ebbs and flows and it changes, but I try and keep that consistency of prayer and meditation to allow me to always keep that door open because I'm going to need them, you know. And so what happened for me is I moved back after college. I got a job. I got married. I had AA people stand at my wedding. I bought a house. I got a career. I just had a kid this year, which is an interesting experience when you're sober and when you're not sober, but it's really fucking weird when you're sober. Because he doesn't really know what the principles are, but I do, you know? And so that's been an interesting journey. But I've been given, I grew up in AA, you know? Like, I had stolen a few cars before I got here, but I didn't have a driver's license. So my sponsor took me at my home group before the meeting, and he would put the cones out, and he taught me how to drive. I had people in this program proofread my college essays, and I told them I didn't want to go, and they said, go, shut up and go, you know? And I had people, you know, get me ready for my wedding and stand with me when I got married. I had people help me set up my accounting software when I opened my own business. I had, you know, like, AA has been there for me with everything. And my life, you know, Jackson, the one thing he said that was probably true was that my life revolves around AA, you know? And I want to briefly go through my experience with the steps and kind of hop around, but my, for me, step one was difficult because I got here so young. You know, like, I honestly think it took me, I would probably told you I was on step four or three or four before I really understood what step one was for me, you know? And it was hard for me to comprehend that in such a short amount of time, I had become powerless over this liquid and that my life was unmanageable. Now, I didn't have any responsibilities. Like, when you're 14, your life to be manageable means you have to, like, put the dishes away after you eat, and you have to do, like, your geometry homework, you know? And I couldn't get out of four-point restraints. And I still was not able to admit that, you know, because I thought I was different. I thought that, you know, I thought that I wasn't going to be able to really buy into this thing as much as you guys, because I hadn't gone through the ringer like you had, you know. And what I had to realize is that I read that doctor's opinion and it clicked for me, you know. I'm an alcoholic because I have a physical allergy with alcohol that when I put it in my body, I don't know when I'm going to stop. And in between those bouts of drinking, I have a mental obsession where all I can do to function is just constantly think about that next time I pick up that drink. That's it. There's no other life outside of that for me. That was my life before I got here. It was just those two states, and I related that to a T. So thank you, Billy D, for that. The doctor's opinion was what really hammered it home. And then I also, my sponsor would tell me, look, the first step pretty much tells you you're fucked, and 2 through 12 give you the hope that there's something else after this, you know? And so I had to really bring myself all the way down, scorecards reading zero. And then I had to start working on the rest of the steps. And, like, for me, what happened was I had 4 or 5 months sober, and I was starting to see that I was getting better, and it's really scary when you're starting to see you're getting better, because if you're like me, that you hate yourself, you know, and you don't think you deserve to get better. You know, like, my sponsor once told me that I'm selfish and self-centered to the core, and I said, there's no way, because I hate myself. I'm a big piece of shit. And he said, well, no, you're still thinking about yourself. You're just thinking about how much you hate yourself. It's the same as if you're thinking you're the best guy in the room. And progress has been made, because sometimes I now think I'm the best guy in the room, and I also hate myself. So, but what happened is that, like, when you're, you know, at this point I was probably 15, and when you're 15, it's hard to go down to a liquor store. I mean, you know, I had my bum connections, but it's hard to go down and grab a bottle. So what I did was just like every other, you know, ninth grader, as I went down, when you're struggling with an issue, and I went down to the supermarket and stole a bunch of cough syrup, and I was walking home, and my phone rang, and it was a guy in this program, and he's like, what are you doing? And for whatever reason, I said, well, I just bought a bunch of cough syrup. I'm going to go home and just, like, get obliterated and never talk to any of you again. And he told me that that was a bad idea. And he asked me if I had prayed before, and I said no. Because when I got here, I was what the Big Book defines as violently anti-religious. The 12 and 12 talks about the atheist as somebody that can prove the non-existence of God, and that's what I thought I was. I would sit in the subway stations and try and panhandle, and whenever I'd see, like, the religious folks to hand out pamphlets, I would just, like, jump on that, you know, and start attacking them about their beliefs and ideas. And I thought that I knew everything, you know. So that's what I brought to you guys. And so when he asked me if I'd prayed, I absolutely not, you know. And he asked me if I would pray to his higher power and just ask for help. And for whatever reason I did, I was just desperate, you know, because when you get here, you know, in your first day, when you get sober, it's not all peaches and roses, you know. It's the only thing that ever worked for me is now being removed, and I haven't figured out the solution that's going to work long term, you know. Like 3-4 months is a dangerous place to be. And I did that, and I prayed, and I threw that stuff away, and he picked me up for a meeting. And for me, that was the start of my second step, because I struggled with the fact that I would ever be restored to sanity, because I had people on paper telling me that I was insane basically my whole life. And I'm telling you now that that definition of sanity, that soundness of mind, can come true, and it has for me at times. And so that second step, that really launched me into the program, and the step work, you know, because what happened was I went to meetings all the time, and I talked to people, and I hung out, and I went to Denny's, and I picked up chairs, and I still was hurting, you know, and my sponsor took the book, and he was like, have you read this? And I was like, absolutely. And then he asked me a couple of basic questions, like what's the first chapter called? And I didn't know, because I had never read it, you know? And I'll be honest with you, the fellowship got me here long enough to stay to realize that I needed the book and the steps to really recover. But I didn't recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body from fellowship. I did it from my step work, you know? And I did it reading the big book, you know? And what happened was, my experience with step three was that I had used you guys, the group, as my second step, my higher power to start with, you know? They talk about, here's a group of people that have overcome something that you couldn't do by yourself. And every time I had sat in that hospital bed and said, I'm never drinking again, 24 hours later, that changed, you know? And for whatever reason, for the first 4-6 months that I was here, I hadn't drank, you know? And you guys hadn't drank either. And there was something miraculous about that, and I couldn't understand what it was, but I didn't need to. I had resigned from the debating society, and I knew that I was able to trust you guys as a group, that we were going to get better together. And so that was the only thing that I had ever trusted in my life. So my third step was simple. It was to go on with the rest of the steps. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God, which at that point was AA. And a lot of people say that their variations of a higher power has morphed over the years and evolved. And that's been true for me as well, but it's been devolved many times too, you know, and the concept of the group is a powerful one, and it's not just a concept for beginners. It's something that I lean on heavily now, still to this day. And so what I did was I was asked to get my first homework assignment in AA, you know, write down this inventory. And I was, like, so excited because I had all these other kids that got sober around my time, and they were like, oh, man, we're doing our four-step. And so I kept being like, I want to do my fourth step. My sponsor would be like, shut up, just wait. And then he finally told me, all right, you ready? And then I just freaked out, you know. I was like, I don't want to do this. And I sat on it for a little bit, you know. And I've never met anybody with long-term meaningful sobriety that hasn't done a fourth and fifth step. Now, if you've met somebody like that, please talk to me after the meeting, but that's just my experience. And I had to basically put blinders on, because I was only scared of this inventory process because I was afraid of what I had to do next, and that was share it. And I had to put blinders on, and I had to write that stuff down. I did it out of the big book. I did the four columns. I met this guy once that didn't know there's a fourth column. I was like, you gotta turn the page, dude, you know? And what I had told Nadav that I was gonna watch my mouth, but everybody else has been cursing this weekend anyway, so I figured I'd tell you my quick four-step story. Two things. One, my sponsor told me, you have to do your four-step like you used to cut yourself. Go down, not across. Yeah, that's how we did it, you know? And then the other thing was that there was an old-timer that told me that he said, the first column, you got to write down the motherfuckers. And I said, perfect, I can do that. There's plenty of motherfuckers out there. And he said, the second column, you got to tell me what the motherfuckers did to you. And I was like, that's easy, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, how much time you got? And he said, and the third column is going to be really easy. There's going to be a little word bank, and you're just going to have to pull a couple things that you think relate to those people. And then the fourth column, you might want to ask for some help. We got to talk about your part. And he kind of brushed that aside. And I said, you know what, I can do this, you know? Like, if the instructions are laid out. That was the layman's terms I needed. And what happened was that when I was writing that fourth step, I started to see patterns even before anybody else had looked at it. Because that third column, there's only so many times you can keep writing the same thing over and over again without noticing where you're at. And the patterns were starting to develop. And, you know, I did fears list and sex inventory. And one thing that my sponsor had me do was write a reservations list. And he wanted me to write down things that he thought that I thought would take me back out again. And what happened is I went to do my fist up, and I was sitting on the bus with my legal pad, and I was gripping it real tight because I knew that everybody on the bus was going to read this. Because I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. And I got there, and we sat down, and we started to read, and it was probably the most powerful experience I've had in my life, because it was the first time that I was able to form a true partnership with another human being. And what had happened is, through my drinking, I had so many compartments of my life that it was exhausting, because I had to look at you and figure out what road were you on? What lies have I told you so that I could keep all my stories straight, you know? And I had finally now, at that point, told everything to one person. I didn't have to figure out where he was and what I needed to say to keep him on his story. He knew everything. And it was a freeing feeling. And in the middle of that freeing feeling, the Comcast guy comes to fix the cable. And I was pissed. But I'm an adult now, and I realized this guy took a day off of work, and he needed to get shit done also. And so this guy's like, you know, I'm here to fix cable. And I was like, okay, well, I just went into his back room, and we kept reading, and I was real uncomfortable because I thought the cable guy was, like, listening to all this stuff. And, you know, my list was, like, total shit. I was, like, resentful of my Spanish teacher, you know? And so what happened was that he asked me to sit for an hour, which I did not do the first time I did the fist step. And that's just my experience. I should have. I was just giddy and hung out at, you know, the coffee shop with the guys, but I've done it in other fist steps that I've worked. But that moment I talked about when I came up to Buffalo for Toronto was the day after I did my fist step. And I remember sitting at the World Convention in the arena holding hands with tens of thousands of other alcoholics saying the Serenity Prayer, and I just started crying, because that was the first moment that I really realized that that this was the place I needed to be. My sponsor reached over the table after I finished reading step five, and he said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was it, you know. And my favorite part in the book is that there's promises after every step. And the promises with the fifth step on page 75 talk about we will now be able to look the world in the eye. And that was it. Like, I was finally able to come clean with somebody, come clean with my higher power and another human being. And for me, what that means is that I'm able to show up for life's responsibilities and take and be accountable for my actions, good or bad. You know, it's hard for me sometimes to accept praise when I do something well. It's also hard for me to stand up when I fuck up with something, you know, but that's what that's the gifts that this step and working this program have given me. And then, you know, I've got, you know, with step six and seven was my bar mitzvah of rite of passage. There you go, Andy. from the men, you know, coming from the boys to the men. And it's something that I, boys to men, nice. It's something that I still struggle with, and I'm actually working with a sponsee right now in 6 to 7, and it's amazing when you dive back in how much there is. Because what my life is now is basically just getting my ass kicked by 6 and 7 constantly and learning from it. And so my first round with the steps, I did that, and I said, I'm working 6 and 7, and my sponsor said, really? I don't think you understand what it means, you know? And he just told me to keep doing what I was doing, and eventually it just hurt so bad that I needed help. And I talked to him about it. And what he had me do was, obviously, you know, there's that prayer for that willingness to be entirely ready. And it's not just the defects that are hurting me. It's all of my defects. It's not my job to figure out what I want God to remove. I can't tell him, well, I've kind of been on a road rage kick here. God, take that one out. But keep these ones here because they're good defense mechanisms for me. My job now is to be of service to God and my fellows, and whatever it takes to be of service is what I should be willing to do. Now, I'm not at that place all the time, you know, but, you know, taking the opposite of my defects and acting as if to then, you know, ask for them to be removed has been my experience that has helped me to really get through that. And then for step eight, you know, I made a list of all these people and I went over with a sponsor, and I advocate that, and I think it's really important because I had people on my list that were going to kill me because of the money that I owed them, and he took them off my list. They weren't like, it wasn't like KFC, it was like drug dealers. I paid like the KFCs back and stuff. But And then I had like one or two ex-girlfriends on there that I wanted to be like, look, I'm sober now. Can we go to like a hardcore show together and hook up? And he was like, no, take those off too. So what I was left with was the ones that weren't really fun. It was the ones I'd actually like harmed. And I had to be entirely willing for all those amends, not just the ones that were convenient. And I had to have the willingness for whatever the expectation was, because this is not an opportunity for me to say sorry. I had done that many times, including in my first 6 months of sobriety. I went around and told every, I did my like nine step early, which if any of you have, it's a terrible experience because everybody's like, really? I don't believe you at all because you just stole from me like 2 weeks ago. And sorry wasn't going to cut it anymore for me, because I would tell you sorry and you'd turn around and I'd grab your wallet out of your back pocket, you know. And what I had to do was I had to play the slow game and really show by example with a lot of these people that my life had changed. And when that time finally came that I made that amends to my parents, they told me that they love me and that they love AA, and they want that what I can do to make things right is to keep doing this. And my parents are like the best people in the world. Like, there's no flaws with them, I promise you. And they accepted you guys into their house. I mean, can you imagine like taking a 15-year-old kid to fucking LA for an Icky Pop for 4 days and just being like, all right, see you later, you know, have a good time. But they did that, you know, because they were like, we know that this is what he needs and we can't give him what he needs. They have AA people come over to their house for dinner all the time. They always ask me how was the meeting? How's so-and-so doing? And it's amazing what non-alcoholics, the impact that they can have on an alcoholic's life. And then I'll speed up real quick because I'm running out of time here, but 10-step inventory for me is extremely important, especially as I maintain my sobriety and my spiritual condition. I like to cop out, and I hear myself and a ton of people at meetings just say like, well, I'm kind of at this echelon now where I just do spot check inventory all the time, which is total bullshit for me, because I can do a spot check inventory, that's great, but it's one thing to do a spot check, it's another thing to sit down with a pen and paper. And I don't do it as much as I'd like to, but when I do, I feel better. And it's amazing how when I feel better, I still kind of have that amnesia, and I'm like, well, let's try it on my own today. But, you know, and then when you're wrong, to promptly admit that is a total foreign concept for me. But if you've ever had to make amends in sobriety, like a direct amends, it'll give you the motivation to admit when you're wrong right away, because it's pretty painful to be like, hey, I know we've been sober like 7 years, but I need to sit down and, you know, right or wrong. So that kind of experience that I've had has been that motivator, that if you comment on somebody's clothing and they're upset about it, to just say, hey, I was wrong. Sorry about that. Which happened this weekend. And then in terms of 11 and 12, like my relationship with, if I'm going to practice step 11, we always have to look at the steps prior and go back and do work. If I'm not able to continue a conscious contact with God, if there's no contact there, where am I going? I'm going back to 2 and 3 and figuring out to establish that contact again. And I have done amazing things. And what I love about 11-step meetings and when I talk to people is there's just a huge wide range of experience of how people relate to God, their own concept of God. And just being able to kind of do that, achieve that seeking without it being dangerous is an amazing thing. I tell people countlessly that I've resigned from the debating society, but I still enjoy seeking out, you know, different ways to communicate with God. And I personally am an outdoors guy. I spend a lot of time out there, and that's been really my church and my solace, you know, to find that. And for step 12, I would say that it's really what I struggle with the most now, because I know how difficult it is to practice these principles in all my affairs, and not just in a lot of my affairs, but all of them. Because sometimes I want to just take my will back and say, this little part, I know what's best. You know, I still know what's best. Helping another alcoholic has been the most rewarding thing in my entire life, because when I came in here, the reason why you guys resonated with me on that first day was because you were not paid, court-appointed, required by law to ask me how I was doing. You just reached out your hand because you really cared, and you knew that it would help you stay sober. And that experience of one alcoholic helping another, that unique experience to AA, that simple purpose, you know, that's that primary purpose, is the only reason that I stuck around. Because I had had plenty of judges, lawyers, cops, doctors, therapists tell me things that were really good advice and true. But they hadn't lived through it. They hadn't walked through that. So I didn't hear it at all. You guys, when you told me that, I knew the genuineness of it. I knew that you had walked through it, and I was able to listen. And the 12-step work that I do now is I try and work with sponsees. I try and pick people up for meetings, the basic stuff that really helps me to stay on a level with those people that the suffering is brand new, you know, like those scars have not healed over yet, you know, and it helps me remember where I came from. And I remember my first couple of years when I was still in high school and I was still skipping school all the time, because when you get sober, you don't get better. We would like go into like crack houses and like clean out. Like we went to this meth lab once and cleaned out all this shit because this guy wanted to get sober, like these awesome 12-step calls that we thought were going to blow up. And those are great, you know what I mean? But I have to like go feed the bottle to the baby now, you know what I mean? So I can't go to the meth house anymore. But at least for right now, you know, maybe later I'll do that again. But what I do now is that one-on-one connection has really allowed me to understand what other people are going through and understand how similar it is to me. It's amazing to me that like the speakers this week and the people that I've met that I'd never met before, I related to like almost 100% of what they said. And that's incredible. You know, like you try and go plop down in another city and just sit in the coffee shop and relate to random people. It's impossible. But, you know, we've escaped disaster together, and there's a reason for it, you know, because we all have this disease. And I'm really grateful to be here. And I just, the last thing I want to say is that I grew up in AA, and I'm still growing up in AA, and I haven't done anything by myself. And the things that I do by myself, I fall on my face, you know, like, and I have a network now of people, sober people, men and women that have changed my life and that I care about. And there's always boundless opportunities in AA to, increase your connection, your spiritual connection, your personal connection with anybody. But what I have to remember is the basics. I have to remember that I need to plug in with people, read the book, pray, go to meetings, and talk to another alcoholic. And after that, the other things that I do, and, you know, the weird meditations and the herbal teas and the hikes and the, you know, all this, then the retreats, you know, and the conferences, those things are all enhancing my spiritual condition. But I have to remember that I have to keep the basic stuff or I'm going to end up back on that hospital bed. I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you all for listening. I'll keep coming back. Thanks for letting me share.
Can we thank Jeff one more time for that wonderful talk?